Hillary Clinton shatters a glass ceiling. Bill Clinton recasts her image. Iowa's delegation celebrates women. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Dean Borg, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. During the next hour, we'll be hearing how Iowa's delegation to the Democratic National Convention is conforming to Democratic Party unity and how Iowa's delegates are reacting to Hillary Clinton's historic nomination and its effect on Iowa's election. Comments from journalists Kay Henderson and James Lynch in Philadelphia and political analysts Diane Bystrom and Tim Hagel. It's all coming up after the NPR News. Dean Borg continuing River to River now, and this is going to be an action-packed program. We have guests strung out across the country. We're all live, and we hope it all falls together the way that we'd planned. James Lynch and Kay Henderson are with us from Philadelphia at the Democratic National Convention. Jim is a political writer for the Gazette, published in Cedar Rapids. Kay, of course, is Radio Iowa's news director. And Tim Hagel is with me in the studio in Iowa City for Iowa Public Radio. He is a University of Iowa political scientist. Hi, Kay.
Hey there.
Tim. And Kay, are you there?
I am.
And Jim?
I'm here.
Okay. Diane Bystrom also, who directs Iowa State University's Carrie Chapman Catt Center for Women and Politics, is going to be in our Ames studio. She, of course, is much in demand right now because of the historic event last night and the involvement of women in being nominated to the presidency of the United States. She was doing some interviews earlier, and she's going to be in the studio just as quickly as she can. We'll call her in just a bit later. But Jim and Kay are going to be with us during the first half hour, so I want to get their insights and what they're seeing among the Iowa delegation at the Democratic National Convention, first of all. Jim, the image that's being projected is unity. Is it solid oak or is it veneer?
It's definitely a soft wood at this point, Dean, and it really we really saw that this morning at the Iowa delegation breakfast, where they have a breakfast every morning where the whole delegation comes together. And they heard an apology from a vice chairman of the Democratic National Committee for those emails that DNC staffers sent out that seemed to indicate they were kind of putting their thumb on the scales for Hillary Clinton, which is something that the Bernie Sanders delegates have been saying. And Archie Ryback offered a formal apology for that and said that was in no way, you know, they were not going to tolerate that. However, that didn't really seem to be enough for a lot of the Sanders delegates at the breakfast. There was anger, frustration. They felt hurt. I think they all understand what the end goal is, but they're not all there yet.
Kay, is that, and I'm playing off what Jim just said, they're not all there. But he said, yet. Is that going to be mitigated then in the coming weeks?
It could be. As Jim described, there were raw emotions on display this morning. As one Sanders delegate put it, we've been treated like children. They were particularly upset that four of the delegates, including the party chairman, announced Iowa's vote tally during that roll call of the states, that sort of iconic event where every state talks about its attributes and then announces how the state votes in the presidential nominating contest. Many other states, for example, Minnesota to our north, had Amy Klobuchar, a U.S. senator who was a Clinton supporter, announced the Clinton delegate total for Minnesota,
Kay.
And then had
Kay, before you go any further, I'm going to let our listeners hear what you're talking about and then put it in perspective so that we have. Now, the first voice we're going to hear is Baltimore Mayor and Democratic National Committee Secretary Stephanie Rawlins Blake, who's calling the roll.
Iowa, you have 51 votes.
How do you cast your votes?
My name is Sruthi Polony
and I am from Iowa, a state of female firsts. In 1857, the University of Iowa became the first state university to accept women into its degree program.
And I'm Congressman Dave Loebsack, congressman from Iowa's 2nd District, where in 1869, Arabella Mansfield became the first woman in America to pass the bar and become an attorney.
My name's Dan Holman. I'm president of AFSCME Iowa Council 61, international president of AFSCME International, where 58% of our membership is female. We believe in equal pay for equal work and dignity for all workers.
Madam Secretary, I am Andy McGuire, the delegation chair for Iowa, where it all started. We proudly cast 21 votes for Senator Bernie Sanders and 30 votes for the first woman to be nominated by any party and the next president of the United States, Hillary Clinton.
Okay, Kay, now that our listeners have that perspective, tell us what the problem is.
The four voices you heard were all Clinton supporters. Sanders supporters were not included in this moment in the sunshine. As I was explaining, in Minnesota, they had Congressman Keith Ellison, who was an ardent Bernie Sanders supporter, announce during that moment for Minnesota the Sanders support. So there are a lot of hurt feelings over that. And the Sanders folks feel as if, you know, if you want us to be part of this party, you have to reach out and hear our concerns. Ingrid Olson, who some of your listeners may remember as one of the plaintiffs in Varnum decision that legalized same-sex marriage in Iowa, is a delegate from Council Bluffs at this convention. She's a Bernie Sanders supporter. And this morning she said, quit telling us that, you know, all we need to do is vote for Hillary Clinton because Donald Trump is bad. Tell us why voting for Hillary Clinton is good.
Jim, anything to add to that? Because the next question I'm going to ask, if you don't have something to add to what Kay had there, is how were these people chosen? That was going to be a question anyway before Kay gave that perspective.
Dean, the one thing I would add is that one of the delegates, Sanders backers, stood up and said, don't tell us to be good losers. That's not the message we want to hear. They want to feel like they're being included in the party and in the delegation. And like Kay was saying, it really goes back to being excluded from that roll call. And as far as how those people were selected, Ben Fecky of the State Democratic Party said most states have their party leaders announce their votes during the traditional roll call. And so they had Andy McGuire, who is the delegation chair and the state party chair, Danny Holman, who is a vice chairman of the delegation, Dave Loebsack, a congressman, and then Clinton delegates chose Sabuthi Palan as the fourth person. And he thought that was absolutely all right, since it was, you know, a big night for Hillary Clinton. It does seem like maybe it was a little bit tone deaf not to include any Sanders person in that. I heard one of the Democratic Party staffers say, well, if you're watching TV, you saw a lot of Sanders people standing around them when they announced the Iowa vote.
Well, the other thing I want to ask, Kay, is they all, Iowa, you know, if Wyoming, for example, said we're the home of the buffalo, and somebody in South Dakota said we have the National Monument and so on. Iowa was highlighting the role of women in the history of the state. And how did that come? How did that play among the delegation, among the delegates?
Well, that's just more salt in the wound, because the prelude to announcing that, you know, there was this core of Bernie Sanders support is that we're so excited that the first woman is going to be nominated. There was no hat tip to Bernie Sanders whatsoever in what was said on behalf of Iowa on the floor last night. And that phrase, you know, female first, was something that was picked up from the convention program that was planned, of course, by the Clinton campaign.
Mm-hmm.
So it really had the potential of being a moment for showing unity among Iowa Democrats, representing both Sanders and Clinton folks. And for some reason, as Jim said, they were absolutely tone deaf to what they were doing.
Diane Bystrom, are you in the Ames studio with us? Guess that she hasn't joined us yet. I was going to bring her into the conversation.
Dean, I would just add that the Sanders delegates pointed out that among the elected members of the delegation, there were 23 Clinton delegates and 21 Sanders delegates. So the elected delegates are nearly evenly split. And I think that was, you know, this whole issue of the superdelegates bothers them. And the fact that the elected delegates were evenly split, they felt like they should have played a bigger role in making that announcement.
I have another cut here, and that is of Bernie Sanders speaking later than Vermont deferred and wanted to be at the end of the roll call vote. And so they went after the W's and all the other states, and West Virginia, I guess, was really last. But Vermont then spoke last and was called then.
Madam Chair, I move that the convention suspend the procedural rules. I move that all votes cast by delegates be reflected in the official record. And I move that Hillary Clinton be selected as the nominee of the Democratic Party for President of the United States.
Now, how did that go over after then the Iowa delegation didn't like the way that they were presented on national television in the calling of their state's role? But then Bernie Sanders got up and asked for, and it may not be acclamation because he asked that, as you heard him, he asked that the real cast votes be recorded as the official record, but that by voice vote, Hillary Clinton be nominated. How did that go over then with the Iowa delegation, Jim? Did they all shout yes?
I really don't know. I mean, I really haven't heard them talking about that. I think it probably the way he worded his motion reflects the fact that his supporters did not want to be released. They wanted to be bound, and I think the fact that he did not say by acclamation or cast a unanimous ballot probably was sort of deferring to their fervor and their desire that his name be a part of the record.
Mm-hmm.
But I really haven't heard much discussion of his actual motion.
What else, Kay, can you tell us about the fervor of the Iowa delegation? There seemed certainly to be, as I watched the television screen with the casting of the votes, there was Andy McGuire, the state Democratic chair. She had a smile as white as a mile and was really excited. Is that excitement about the convention, about the nominee, overcoming what you've just been talking about and the dissident of Bernie Sanders delegates?
Well, back to your previous question, I wasn't able to be on the floor. It's a very complicated process, and there are a limited number of credentials for media to be physically on the floor to know what's going on. But via Twitter and text message, James and I were both able to confirm that, you know, some of these Sanders delegates immediately left the floor and they were part of a kind of a mass sit-in.
The Iowa delegates among them?
Yes. Some of those Iowa delegates who supported Bernie Sanders went out and did a mass sit-in in the media tent. Of course, one of the institutions that Senator Sanders has attacked during the campaign is the quote-unquote corporate media. And so one of the ways in which they could show their angst, if you will, and not, you know, leave the complex, so to speak, was to have a sit-in. They wound up being back in their seats later when Bill Clinton talked.
The question I'm going to ask, and we're going to bring Tim Hagel into this discussion here, but I'll go to you, Jim, first of all, before we hear from Tim. What do you think are the implications once these people come back to Iowa, really leaving Philadelphia as a split or at least a peeved party? What are the implications for other Iowa Democrats who will be on that November ballot? What should they be hoping for? Because all eyes now are on the Clinton effect, but What about the Jim Mowers, the Patty Judges, the Mike Gronstals, the Monica Vernons?
Well, that's interesting, Dean, that you asked that, because I was talking to a woman who is at the convention from Iowa. She's not a delegate, but she was talking about, you know, how do we go back to Iowa? And
I think we're losing his signal. Kay, are you still on?
I am still on.
Yes.
And just to pick up on what James is saying, I mean, the fascinating thing here is that you have something remarkably similar happening in both parties. You have fervent Ted Cruz supporters on the Republican side who are, you know, planning to work for Republican candidates up and down the ticket, but they are not going to vote for Donald Trump. I think you're going to see Democrats who are labeling themselves progressives among this revolution that they talk about, that Senator Sanders has inspired among them. And they are going to work for candidates, maybe for the legislature, work hard, knock on doors, but they may not be as motivated about that top of the ticket person.
I'm going to come back to you in a moment, and maybe we'll have Jim's cell phone signal back on by that time. And, Kay, I'm going to ask you in just a moment the Iowa reception to Bill Clinton's recasting of Hillary's image, given what you've just been talking about. But, Tim, pick up on the previous question, if you will, then we'll go back to Kay.
Sure. I agree pretty much with what Kay is saying, and we're seeing it again in both parties where there's a strong remaining division. But as James had indicated earlier with the yet comment, that I think that right now feelings are still a little bit hurt for the Democrats. Of course, they're still in their convention, and that will fade a little bit. And I think that there will be appeals. And even what we're seeing in the Democratic convention are there appeals to continue to work not just for the presidential candidate, for the other candidates down the ticket. We didn't see that, those types of appeals, as much in the Republican convention. But as Kay was sort of indicating, we do see that among the parties, the state parties, that they are going to encourage their people to work for other candidates. Of course, we've got the Senate race here in Iowa, along with the congressional and state legislative races, and that will be the case in other states as well, where you want to make sure that those down-ticket races get the support, even if you're not necessarily strongly on board for your presidential candidate.
Kay, we're ready for you.
Diane Beister here. Can I weigh in on this, Dean?
Yes, yes, go ahead.
Sorry, I'm joining a little late. I actually, because I was in the middle of a move, got to see the entire Republican National Convention and the last 2 days of the Democratic Convention. And one of the things that struck me, and Kay, you're at the convention right now, is that, you know, really what we're looking at for both the Hillary Clinton and the Bernie Sanders supporters are their most ardent supporters. Those are the people that run to be delegates. Those are the people that put themselves in Philadelphia this week. I looked at some polling done by the Pew Research Center, a very reputable organization looking at voters during the primary, and I think their study came out on Tuesday. And what they found is that there was actually a lot of movement in the Democratic primary from Clinton to Sanders, from Sanders to Clinton, back and forth, a lot of movement between those two camps. But what they found overall is when you looked at those consistent Sanders supporters that vote, you know, kept with Sanders the entire time, almost 90% of them say that they're voting for Clinton. And so I think that kind of gets drowned out a little bit by the process at the Democratic National Convention, because a lot of these are newcomers to politics. They're very excited. I'm excited for them. There are a lot of them could be, you know, young people like I deal with every day at Iowa State. But I think, like Tim just said, is that their feelings are hurt. I mean, you can't go into that kind of situation without having hurt feelings. And so I think they're still going through a grieving process. But I think, you know, by the time the election comes forth, maybe some of the hurt feelings won't go away, but I think a lot of them will. But I think you also have to focus on the big picture of the people that aren't at the convention that were Sanders' consistent supporters. Upwards of 90% of them say that they're going to vote for Clinton, and that's way higher than the women that, and men that were hurt because Barack Obama was the candidate in 2008.
That plays right into the question I'm asking then of Kay. Iowa's reception, if you will, Kay, or reaction to Bill Clinton's recasting of Hillary's image, saying you've been looking at a cartoon image.
Well, one thing that happened on Sunday among these delegates is they had a social event. They went to a bowling alley. And what occurred to me is that every lane had, they were pods, a pod of Bernie Sanders supporters playing on one lane and a pod of Clinton supporters playing on the other. And this morning during this very emotional meeting, There was a young female delegate from Iowa who is a Sanders supporter who stood up and said for the first time she heard that Hillary Clinton was just like her when Hillary Clinton was her age, and talked about the things that she had learned for the first time by listening to what was said on the convention floor. And she was conveying that, you know, I need to have more of that information. And the reason she hadn't had that information before about, you know, Hillary Clinton working with migrants in Texas and, you know, doing voter registration and working on behalf of children for the Children's Defense Fund is because she was in her own pod. She was in and around Bernie Sanders supporters throughout the breadth of the campaign. And so now they're being exposed to information about Hillary Clinton, positive information that they may not have ever had access to because of their Facebook feed, because of the Twitter people that they keep track of, because of the media, social media that they consume.
Jim, are you back with us?
I am.
Yes. You've heard the discussion there. Anything that you want to add?
Well, I would say this, Dean, and Diane touched on this a little bit. There is sort of a generational difference between Sanders and Clinton supporters. Not all Sanders supporters are young, but many of them, this is really their first heavy involvement in the process. And losing is hard. And speakers this morning, Archie Ryback, Dave Lobsack, talked about, you know, they've all lost and they've learned something from that. But some of these first-timers really don't want to hear that message. they want their candidate to win. I mean, they're, you know, they have the team spirit. And I think it'll be interesting. Tom Harkin talked about, you know, if you don't like the positives I can tell you about Hillary Clinton, then I'm just going to say Trump. And he hopes that that's enough. One word, that name is enough to get everybody on board. We'll have to wait and see.
Kay, I know. Go ahead.
I would add that one of the interesting things that has happened during the course of this is that Tom Harkin, no longer a member of the U.S. Senate, has sort of been right smack dab in the middle of this whole debate, and he is a Hillary Clinton supporter. But the way he's described his own political journey, having supported George McGovern, and talking about the 1968 campaign and supporting the Bernie Sanders, if you will, candidate in that particular race, has really sort of resonated with the Sanders people, and they're speaking, some of them are speaking glowingly about him. So he's playing an interesting role in this dynamic of how the Clinton pod and the Sanders pod are interacting with one another.
Just before we get up to news time here and before we lose you in Philadelphia, Jim and Kay, give us a little perspective on Danny Holman's role and whether or not that prominent role is going to be able to deliver the Iowa labor vote.
Well, I think, you know, the Hillary Clinton folks and the Democratic Party are counting on it. You know, Donald Trump has made inroads into sort of that white male working class voting group. That would include a lot of union members. And I think they're counting on people like Danny Holman to send the message that, you know, you may like some of his rhetoric, but you're not going to like his policy.
And that, we are out of time. Kay and Jim, thanks for on the fly, on the cell phone, being with us, giving you that on the scene perspective. We appreciate it very much. We'll be back in a minute. Just to add the latest from the Democratic National Convention, when we were talking with James Lynch of the Gazette and Kay Henderson of Radio Iowa, they were on cell phone and they had other responsibilities and have left us now. But Diane Bystrom, who directs Iowa State University's Carrie Chapman Catt Center for Women and Politics, is in our Ames studio. And Tim Hagel is with me here in the Iowa City studio. He's a University of Iowa political scientist. I would say, Diane and Tim, that we are seeing the big entertainment stars. We're seeing the superstars of the Democratic Party all on the program. President Barack Obama speaking tonight. And just earlier in the week, Michelle Obama made these comments in her speech Monday night at the Democratic National Convention. We've shortened some of the applause just for time's sake.
When she didn't win the nomination 8 years ago,
She didn't get angry or disillusioned. Hillary did not pack up and go home. Because as a true public servant, Hillary knows that this is so much bigger than her own desires and disappointments.
Diane Bystrom, there's a massive recasting of the image of Hillary Clinton, and Bill Clinton contributed to that last night. It started maybe with Michelle Obama. But what is it that you saw last night? Because you told me earlier you were watching nonstop, and you saw that video imaging of the shattering glass ceiling. And she was that is, Hillary Clinton was standing with a group of children there addressing by video the convention. And she was saying the message here is girls who are watching now believe they can be here sometime. That was a powerful, powerful statement. I'm wondering if you agree.
Oh, absolutely. There's been a lot of research in the area, basically on the role model effect and the effect that it has on women running for political office. And the interesting thing is it seems to cut across party lines. So, for example, there was a dissertation that came out of Harvard University a couple of years ago showing that, called it a multiplier effect, and when a state elects its first woman to the Senate or as governor, it actually has an effect of having more women in both parties run for the state legislature. So certainly, I think we even have seen that in Barack Obama's administration, where he and his wife have told stories about young African American men and women believing now that they can be president because they see someone like them. And it's, again, role model effect, and I think the fact that when women see other women of either party in high political office, it does, I think, have things affect on their political ambition. And that's where in the literature we see the big difference between men and women is that even when they're equally qualified for office, women are hard on themselves and they don't think they're as qualified as men. And so, you know, that's what we have to solve. And actually, unfortunately for those of us like Tim and I in higher education, it actually, the gap grows in college. And so I think we have a real responsibility as college professors to encourage both men and women to run for office or be in somehow public service.
Yeah, as far as that, this is Tim. As far as the role model effect, that's certainly the case, and certainly want to see that. And it's interesting that you have more lower level candidates from either ethnicities or gender or what have you. On the other hand, some of the younger students, to a certain extent, as far as the gender question goes, they almost take it for granted these days that there is a bit of almost a shrugging of shoulders. Well, of course, you know, a woman can be president. What's the problem there? Even though it hasn't happened yet, they seem to expect that, well, it will in fact happen. And plus, and again, this maybe is more from a Republican point of view or maybe from the moderates or independents that really aren't that engaged with Hillary Clinton, that they say, well, maybe is she the best person for that, given some of the problems that she's had in the past? Now, of course, Bill Clinton kind of talked about that obliquely, saying that those complaints portrayed a cartoonish version of Hillary Clinton. But on the other hand, it's hard to deny that she has been in the news for some negative things, including the email links, although she wasn't directly tied to that, but the fact that the people supporting her had their thumb on the scales, as the phrase goes.
Diane, what are the challenges facing Hillary Clinton as a woman candidate? Are we past that? Has she passed that now that she has the nomination? And from what Tim just said, and I guess you too, that generally society is accepting. But I really wonder if that's true.
Well, I would say we still have a long ways to go. One of my main areas of study since the early 1990s has been media coverage of male and female candidates, particularly when they run against each other. And what I've seen over years is there's much more equity between the media coverage of women and men running for example, Congress or the Senate or even governorships. And there still is just such a discrepancy in the media coverage of women running for the highest office in the land. And we saw that not only with Hillary Clinton in 2008, but also with Sarah Palin. We saw it with Elizabeth Dole. I did a study on that. And so there's not as much. I haven't read one. I've read a lot of studies about Hillary Clinton's coverage, as well as other women running for office at that level. And Hillary Clinton, even in this campaign cycle, has been subjected to much more negative media coverage than even Donald Trump. A recent study that came out from Harvard University while we were still in the primary stage found out that 80% of Hillary Clinton's issue coverage was negative. Compared to like 22% of Donald Trump's, and it could be that he's not really talking about the issue. So I think her biggest challenge is that I do think that there are different expectations of women. Tim put his finger on it. You know, we want a woman, but not that woman, and that's what I heard back in 2008. And so there's also studies that show that even women voters want that first woman to be perfect. And, you know, we don't have perfect political candidates, either male or female. You know, typically they've been, you know, they've had a life. They've had things you can scrutinize. And so I think there are, I think she's held to a higher standard, not only by the media, but also by, I think, voters in general, including women who want to have that perfect woman. But I think the thing that's going on her side the most is that we still have a gender gap in this country. Women tend to vote for the Democratic candidate for president. Men tend to vote for the Republican candidate. The gender gap swings both ways, but it's not exactly equal because women make up a higher percentage of the population. They're registered at higher numbers than men, and they turn out to vote more. In 2012, 10 million more women voted than men. And so Hillary Clinton will get, I think, votes for president because she's a Democratic candidate. So that's what she has going with her. What we're seeing right now in the early polling, even during the primaries, is that this is even, I mean, the two largest gender gaps since 1980 when we started looking at that in political campaigns came in 1996 with Bill Clinton and 2012 with President Obama. Those were double-digit gender gaps, and they both contributed to those two men's election reelection campaigns.
I want to let Tim get a comment in here, yeah. But I want to come back to you almost immediately, Diane, because I have another question about the press corps covering Hillary Clinton. But Tim, you want to pick up on some things that Diane was saying there first?
Yeah, no, it's all part of what we've seen before. As she was saying, a number of studies have shown these sorts of things. I guess the one concern I have is when you talk about, say, the negative publicity or news reports or articles written about one candidate versus another, and especially if you're talking about Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump, is it because of gender? Is it because of a different standard? Or is it because of the actual person? But mm-hmm. because some people maybe feel that there is, and certain circumstances, of course, rightly so, that there is a difference in how people are perceived, male or female, that are you looking for that and do you find it more? And in fact, even this morning I saw a reporter tweet out something from Donald Trump's news conference where the tweet was, well, he told a female reporter to be quiet. Well, he tells male reporters the same thing too, but the point was, this must be sexist because he's telling this to a female reporter, even though he's doing pretty much the same thing to everybody that's in the room that doesn't follow his direction.
Diane, I found your comments and yours too, Tim, extremely interesting because before we went on the air with this program at noon, Fresh Air with Terry Gross had a New York Times female reporter who is exclusively assigned to cover Hillary Clinton. And she was saying, I didn't know this, that it's an all-female press corps covering Hillary Clinton. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that they're the ones who exclusively follow her around. But that doesn't mean that males don't also write stories about Hillary Clinton and report. But Diane, comment on that. You say that Hillary Clinton's getting negative press or isn't getting as favorable press as a male candidate, and yet the people who cover her exclusively are all female.
There have been some of the studies that look at the content analysis of the coverage of Hillary Clinton or actually of any other females running for office. And what they found is, I mean, there was a notion that if more women were covering the female candidate, that they may get more favorable coverage. The limited studies that have looked at that have seen no kind of gendered effect for the gender of the reporters. And what they've concluded is that reporters are somewhat held to institutional standards. They're held to the standard of their newspaper, and they certainly don't want to be accused by their newspaper or their television station for being less stringent on a female candidate because she happens to be female. So again, the limited studies that have factored in the gender of the reporter in covering the male or female candidate that have not shown that female reporters are really any less hard on a female candidate than male reporters. And to one of Tim's points, you know, as far as, you know, I understand that that comes back all the time. Like if you have a candidate that has sort of this negative stuff going on, of course they're going to get more negative coverage. And so the really good content analyses, they have independent coders, the fact, you know, the researcher is not coding themselves. They have, you know, a protocol to do it. And here's just a, you know, example from this campaign from a study that I didn't do, but some others did. They took the word ambitious, and they looked at, coded the word ambitious between a number of political candidates. And in the case of Hillary Clinton, it was almost always ambition was seen as a negative adjective. But in the case of Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, it was seen as a negative, as a positive. And so those are the types of things that we can, I think, nuance the coverage and can say it's not just because of Hillary Clinton's emails. These are the things that she's being covered differently on.
Men are supposed to be ambitious. Women, it's a negative connotation if they are. That's what you're saying. Yep.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I want to go to what Bill Clinton was doing last night, and that is recasting the image that he said Hillary Clinton has nationally.
A real changemaker represents a real threat. So your only option is to create a cartoon. A cartoon alternative, then run against the cartoon. Cartoons are two-dimensional. They're easy to absorb. Life in the real world is complicated, and real change is hard. And a lot of people even think it's boring. Good for you, because earlier today, you nominated the real one.
Tim Hagel. Are there two Hillary Clintons in the public image?
I think that's probably a fair statement in the sense that you see the image that Bill Clinton in that speech and the Democrats in their convention more generally or even more outside the convention want to portray Hillary Clinton as being a very experienced, very knowledgeable in terms of her policies and what she's done, both as a Senate, as well, even First Lady, as a Senator and then Secretary of State. But of course, you have the Republican side of things where they see her as being involved in a variety of schemes and scandals dating back to Bill Clinton's time in the White House. And so the reality is undoubtedly something in the middle. And even to a certain extent, Bill Clinton was kind of hinting at that, saying that, look, change is hard. It doesn't always come easy. But here's what – and then he's trying to portray here's what she has done. And then we talked about that, sort of the extended biographical thing, what she'd done in law school and shortly after and so forth, who she was working for and all of that. And as Diana said before, that there are some people that hadn't heard those stories previously. And basically it's for the younger voters in particular who also don't know some of the stuff that went on and the scandal side of things went on in the 90s, that this is interesting new information for them that they would be able to absorb this. And that's one of the reasons why you talk about this is to partly bring together the Sanders voters along with the Clinton voters.
Diane, now the speakers up to now and President Obama tonight are giving her momentum. That is, what does Hillary Clinton have to do Thursday night when in her speech, when she accepts the nomination, what does she have to do, given everything that you've said? You're saying that she mustn't appear ambitious. She has to be a mother. She has to be a grandmother. She has to be experienced. How is she going to do all of that?
Well, you know, she basically has to seal the deal, and certainly the path for her to do that, you know, has been paved by, you know, I would argue some of the most motivational and moving speeches I've seen have come from people that are just average citizens that somewhere along their path they've crossed with Hillary Clinton, and she stayed in touch with them. Some of the most personal stories I thought actually came from them, you know, and so I think you know, what she needs to do. And I have seen a difference in her this time around. You know, when you live in Iowa, you have the ability to meet most of the presidential candidates on both sides. I've noticed, as other people have, I've noticed a change in Hillary this time around. I do think the fact that, you know, she's a grandmother now, and I think that she has kind of softened out some of her edges. And so, you know, she is more of a policy wonk. You know, she herself says she's not the greatest, and I think even President Obama said in an interview that, you know, she's not the greatest speech giver. So, you know, I think certainly she has to put together, I think, a speech that is multidimensional. One of the things I found in my own research when I look at women's political advertising, for example, that they have to sort of have this persona that's tough but caring. So certainly she has to come across that she can be commander-in-chief. You know, she's got that experience as Secretary of State. But I think this time around, one of the things that she avoided doing in 2008 that she seems more amenable to this year is talking more about herself as not only a mom but a grandmother. And I think that's something that I did a short little study that I did for a conference in April and compared her speeches from 2008 to this cycle and did find some softening of that image and some more willingness to talk about the historic nature of her campaign, because it's aspirational to a lot of, you know, young women, I think, and certainly older women. But also I think she's more willing, I think, to have a more rounded personality this time, a rounded persona, and she does have that. You know, I've started studying political campaigns in 1990, so I've studied Hillary Clinton since she was a first lady. And so, you know, I do know about her. And so I did know all that stuff about her, and I knew that that's what she would do this week, because people my age that have seen her know that she has had a long service in, you know, public life.
Well, let me ask you this then. Do you agree with Bill Clinton that there's a cartoon Hillary and a real Hillary?
I think so, and I think part of it, I would also say, you know, the Clintons are sort of notorious for being shy around the media. They're not very trustworthy of the media. I think they have some reasons for doing that, but I think that, you know, there is some thing to say that they need to be much more amenable to the media, and I think you've seen this time around as well. You know, the thing I was most surprised about is that, you know, I had the opportunity to meet Hillary Clinton in October 2007 when she was a speaker as part of a series that we sponsor at the Carrie Chapman Catt Center for Women in Politics, and never had, you know, I'd seen her at campaign events and been able to meet her in a rope line, but this is the first time I really dealt with her on a personal level. And I actually had succumbed to the caricature of her. You know, I believed what, even though I study media coverage, I thought she's, what you hear about her is that she's cold and she's not very funny. And, you know, when you meet her in person, and you've heard from people in this campaign, is she's actually a very warm, down-to-earth, mm-hmm. humorous person. Well, and I was very surprised the first time I got to meet her at that level.
We have a caller here who's calling about something in her personal character, and it's Troy from Iowa City. Troy? I'll bring him on here if I can. Troy?
Are you actually going to have a Trump supporter come on and as a guest and actually talk about Hillary Clinton? Because what she did, and I don't care what gender she is, she put top secrets. These are our guarded secrets of the United States. The only reason why she is not indicted, if you listen to the FBI guy, is she was so incompetent she couldn't be.
Okay,
indicted.
Troy, we've got it, and that's a big question, and I'm glad that you raised it. Thanks a lot for calling, and I'm Tim Hagel. There it is.
Yeah, and this is what I was saying before, is that it's you can portray the warm and energetic and all of that Hillary Clinton, but then there's the other side too, and it's not totally a cartoon. You have, and I saw some clip, I think it was a Republican or a Republican-affiliated group that put together a list of questions that Trey Gowdy, among others in the panel, posed to Comey, the FBI director, and said, did Hillary Clinton do this? Did Hillary Clinton lie about this? She tell the truth? And it's basically she told all these lies. So aside from everything else, there were incidents that are pretty clear and pretty recent where there were problems in terms of what Hillary Clinton was telling the public and the press in certain circumstances. And it's really, to a certain extent, difficult to get past that. So that's part of the conversation as well.
And Diane Bystrom, also the WikiLeaks kind of undercutting Hillary's campaign and how she won the nomination and substantiating Bernie Sanders saying it was rigged.
Well, I think, you know, if you read most of the things about the WikiLeaks, you know, part of it is, and, you know, when you saw those comments and coming out, I think it's really more on the DNC than Hillary Clinton's campaign. I've read through, you can do it, WikiLeaks has a searchable base, you can read through it. There's not really, I mean, most of the smoking guns have been reported by the press, and the worst one is the, you know, the comment about his faith, I believe, and it came from a lower level staffer. And so certainly I think the DNC has cleaned up, has made strides over the course of this convention. I think Debbie Wasserman Schultz should have resigned before the convention. I think Donna Brazile seems to be cleaning up a lot of messes, and actually, so I think it's a DNC problem. It's not so much a Hillary Clinton problem. But back to, you know, the caller, that we are a very divided country right now. And so there are people that will never vote for Hillary Clinton. There are other people that are excited about Hillary Clinton. You know, and right now in our country, a Democratic candidate and a Republican candidate can each poll about 40% of the base of their parties. And so it's up to the other 20% to see how this election is going to go.
Thank you so much for your insights. I've been hearing from Diane Bystrom, who directs Iowa State University's Carrie Chapman Chat Center for Women in Politics. She was in our AIM studio. Tim Hagel was with me in the Iowa City studio for Iowa Public Radio. Tim is a University of Iowa political scientist. We'll let you know, too, that River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. And we had help today from Lauren Knudsen. And our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Dennis Reese provided our technical assistance. I'm Dean Borg, and thanks for joining us.